Chapter 8, On Fighting Unpopular Battles But Being Right. We have fought long and hard to escape medieval superstition, and I, for one, do not want to go back. James Randi. The Secret of Happiness. Find something more important than you are and dedicate your life to it. Daniel Dennett. American atheists began with a mother, a child, and a court case. After Madeline won her epic court battle in conjunction with other plaintiffs, banning mandatory Bible readings in the public schools, she started American Atheists for the sole purpose of continuing the fight for atheist equality, freedom of conscience, and the separation of religion and government. Since then, American Atheists has fought legal battles that may be politically incorrect or unpopular, but are nonetheless vital to the continued evolution of this country. Today, American Atheists has a specific legal philosophy to which we adhere. Simply stated, we fight battles to win. While that may seem obvious, this means we don't file cases for show or for publicity alone. We design and take cases with the intent of triumph. We choose battles to maximize the win potential while minimizing the potential for loss. Many don't understand that when the good guys lose a lawsuit, the bad guys win a lawsuit. And this may set a precedent in the wrong direction, creating new, bad law with long-term and wide-ranging ramifications. Well-intentioned people have contributed to the creation of bad laws with lawsuits that should not have been filed, and I don't want to be one of them. So while we only pick cases we intend to win, we might turn down a case if what we could win doesn't outweigh the risk of losing. We look for cases where our equality is infringed, even if they are small infringements, because each unchallenged infringement is the next case's precedent. Never should we stand by and say, "It's okay, that infringement doesn't mean much to me." Because these small-looking cases are never the end game, but merely stepping stones to the next assault, analogous to drawing Muhammad. This is an important point worth repeating. Our opponents assail our rights using baby steps, not huge leaps, and we must make sure those small assaults to our liberty don't go unchallenged. Having explained the philosophy, let's look at some legal issues of particular concern. Government-imposed religious privilege. Churches and other religious institutions have special rights above and beyond those of other nonprofits because of laws that elevate religion. Such laws are fundamentally contrary to the separation of religion and government. Religious organizations are given more perks, more breaks, and more money because they promote religion. Secular clubs get less simply because they don't, unless they call themselves religious. It's a clear, deliberate, legalized advantage for religion, and it's rampant. For example, thanks to the faith-based initiative, churches provide many services using our tax dollars that should be provided by secular charities, yet churches do so without the same oversight or employment rules. If there is any glaring example of unfair policy that favors religion that President Obama could easily have fixed, it is this one. Obama promised to do just that during his run for office, but he must have forgotten. This policy allows churches to say they will be performing a community service, get federal funds, and spend it without the accountability to which secular charities would be subjected. Sure, they are supposed to perform the services, and some do. And if they do it without preaching or discriminating in hiring, like other nonprofits, that's legal. But we taxpayers don't know how well or how efficiently because of inadequate oversight. Everything we hear on the subject is hype. No numbers, no reports. The churches could be keeping the money and not providing the services. They could be providing the services poorly. They could be preaching their mythology as they provide the service, illegal as they are using public funds to lure in potential converts. We don't know because the public doesn't get to know. Moreover, when this money goes to religious organizations whose personnel are trained to preach religion as a primary goal and not to trained professionals whose primary goal is to provide social services, the government ends up paying underqualified people to perform social services because they are religious or members of a particular religion. churches get federal tax money to provide services in which they are not experts, while secular experts go unemployed and the government thinks this is a good idea. Then, these organizations use their status as social service organizations to, guess what, try to influence public policy on religious freedom issues. In 2011, the Chicago-based Catholic Charities were supposedly on the side of children as they took federal funds to run an adoption agency. But apparently, their religion-based hatred for gay people was far more important as they shut down rather than place kids in gay homes when marriage equality came to Illinois. They claimed, get this, that the government was forcing them to break their religious rules by making them obey the same rules as other organizations and not discriminate. And this is happening all over the country, including Colorado and Washington, D.C., where they also threatened to shut down their help for the homeless if marriage equality passes. In an attempt to sway public policy by holding their social services hostage to promote and preserve bigotry in the name of God. So now, those kids will suffer, the community loses a supposedly secular asset, and according to them, it's the government's fault. Are you angry yet? These organizations are supposedly set up as charities and social services, get government money to do so, but when they have to be fair and non-discriminatory, their compassion goes in the dumpster and children get screwed. And when they shut down, they cry discrimination because they can't make society obey their silly religious rules, and they claim to be ethical. It gets worse, because the faith-based initiative is not even the best, worst example of unfair government treatment of religion. That award goes to the IRS tax code. Nonprofits serve as pseudo-extensions of the government that provide a broad range of services. In general, they are supposed to help their community in some way. The idea is that corporations without stock ownership, the government owns all the stock of nonprofit corporations, are formed by experts to provide services not adequately addressed by the government, and as such, they are exempt from some taxes and receive other benefits. Contrary to what one might think, nonprofits can and do earn profits, but they are restricted on how they spend their profits, they cannot sell shares, and donations are tax deductible. All nonprofits have a degree of oversight and are regulated at the state and federal level, as one might expect of an extension of the government. We must declare our income and expenses and how much we pay for salaries and spend on our social work. All this information is public as we, this includes American atheists, serve the general population. Did I say all nonprofits have oversight? That's wrong. What I should have said is all nonprofits that are not religious have oversight, because religious institutions are not subject to these rules. In fact, churches and religious institutions have a completely different set of rules to which they must adhere, because God. The IRS tax code lists advancement of religion as an official charitable activity, right between relief of the poor, the distressed, and the underprivileged, and the advancement of education or science. Additionally, it adds an if religious, then benefits statement that provides religious institutions benefits that other nonprofits aren't granted. These benefits include a substantially streamlined application process. Religious institutions get nonprofit status by default, avoiding bylaw reviews, wait times, and of course, fees. The Reason Rally Coalition, the 501c3 educational organization set up to run the rally, took months to become official. But if we'd declared ourselves a religious organization, it would have been cheaper and nearly instantaneous. Donor privacy. Donate $5,000 or more to American atheists, and the government hears about it, and so does the general public, because we have to declare you on our yearly tax forms. Donate $5 million to the Church of Scientology, and your privacy is assured because they don't have to declare anything. Think about how that works to prevent major donations to causes such as American atheists, which might be considered controversial, while contributions to religions are completely confidential. Lack of oversight. Religious institutions are assumed to be ethical and efficient, so they are not required by the government to report income or expenses in any way to anyone. According to the IRS, quote, generally, tax-exempt organizations must file an annual information return, Form 990 or Form 990-EZ. Tax-exempt organizations that have annual gross receipts not normally in excess of $25,000, $50,000 for tax years ending on or after December 31, 2010, are not required to file the annual information return. They may be required to file an annual electronic notice, however. In addition, churches and certain church-affiliated organizations are exempted from filing. Churches are only audited by the IRS in extreme circumstances. In fact, the IRS has special rules limiting its own power to conduct such an audit, so it rarely ever happens. But secular organizations are subject to strict rules and regular oversight. In 2009, for example, an IRS agent investigated the Living World Christian Center in Brooklyn Park, Minnesota, and found inappropriate politicking and possible financial improprieties. But the judge in the case ruled the church didn't have to comply with the IRS audit because, get this, the auditor was of insufficient rank. Only high-ranking IRS officials may audit churches. Try that one the next time you get audited. According to Professor Ryan Cragen, churches cost America about $71 billion per year in nonprofit property tax exemptions alone. That's enough for 28 missions to Mars per year, or 1.5 million teachers, or 1.4 million police officers per year. This does not include sales tax breaks, parsonage tax exemptions, or side businesses such as childcare or coffee shops in churches that should be taxable, but thanks to the absence of oversight, churches are assumed to never lie, are sometimes folded into the church books and hidden. How much is all that? We don't know, because the government says we don't need to know. Cragen states these subsidies, that's what they are, need to go. Quote, as the perceived benefit to society of religions becomes increasingly irrelevant as more and more Americans cease to utilize their services by disaffiliating, it will also be increasingly unfair for a large percentage of non-religious Americans, almost 40% in some states, to subsidize the recreational activities of others. These subsidies should be phased out. End quote. Again, the only reason churches and other religious organizations get this perk is because they are religious. This is entrenched religious favoritism by the government. What if the government treated every nonprofit organization equally, regardless of whether it preached about a god? What if the Mormon Church and the Catholic churches were actually required to declare their income and expenses just like every other 501c3? What if the government provided oversight of religious nonprofits, arguably one of the most corrupt industries on the planet, to the same degree it oversees non-religious nonprofits? What if religious nonprofits had to disclose to their parishioners and the country at large just how much they are spending on helping people, just like everyone else? We'd have a very different country. Churches that wanted to do good things would do them, file their forms, help people, and reap the tax benefits just like all the other nonprofits. Churches that didn't want to obey the equally applied nonprofit rules would become for-profit churches, with the full ability to pay stockholders, hide money, and yes, preach politics from the pulpits. I don't like that last part, but it would be fair, just like everyone else. This is how it should be, and this is why American Atheists is suing the IRS. That if religious then benefits statement is religious discrimination incarnate. It has no basis in secular law and promotes religion in America. We demand its removal, and if that means churches have to make a choice whether to be non-profit or for-profit, like every other company in America, then so be it. It's not our problem, and it's not our government's problem that churches will have to adapt to equality. The churches will complain. They will call it an attack because every attempt to equalize is seen as an attack by those losing special rights. They are blinded by their own privilege. But once everyone sees the inherent inequality of assuming all religious activity is by default a, quote, social service, end quote, while non-religious organizations enjoy no such assumption, they will be forced to admit taxing churches equally and with the same oversight as other nonprofits is fair and compliant with the do unto others as you would have done unto you mantra. We have to realize those who complain the most probably have the most to lose because they are benefiting from a flawed system. I am reminded of a 2012 radio debate I had on the subject with a pastor of a Nashville megachurch, which had both a coffee shop and a gymnasium inside its building. The IRS had told the church they had to file tax returns on the side businesses, but the church replied that the side businesses were integral to the church business and contested the ruling. During the dispute, the side businesses remained closed, indicating, one, they were not, in fact, integral to the church, and two, the church was concerned about disclosing any earnings to the U.S. government, so much so that it would rather close the integral businesses than disclose the numbers. Smells like someone is hiding something, doesn't it? By far the most telling moment of that interview occurred when I spoke about oversight and the pastor who had apparently lied to the IRS about the importance of his coffee shop and gym to the functioning of his church actually proposed that churches should self-police. Interestingly, conservatives are prone to respond to demands for fair taxation with an odd and counterintuitive, quote, but without the church tax exemptions, churches would go out of business. Taxing churches is therefore an assault on religion, end quote. This counterintuitive response makes more sense when you think about how the politicians are in the pockets of the preachers. This is akin to saying the government is in the business of supporting religion via a recurring bailout, as it's taking extra taxes from the citizenry to indirectly fund the churches through tax exemptions they do not otherwise deserve. The government has bailed out scores of corporations. ProPublica has a bailout tracker because it and many other people, mostly conservatives, oppose bailouts from the government. They believe in the free market system, capitalism, and therefore businesses that fail should be allowed to fail. Yet, when it comes to the continuing bailout of the religious system, we as a nation turn a blind eye. We somehow feel it's a bad thing to let sick churches fail, and that it's the government's job to keep them in business. Even those who oppose the most defensible corporate bailouts support the government's funding of religion in this manner and accuse us of attacking churches when all we seek is fair taxation. They are wrong. Churches that cannot support themselves should fail, and it's not our problem. It's certainly not the government's job to keep churches open and pastors paid. The government's current system is clearly illegal and un-American, and we, as taxpayers, deserve the right not to support the dying religion industry by force of taxation. In this very real way, the government has been keeping religion alive long after it should have withered and died. According to ProPublica, the U.S. government bailout from Morgan Stanley was $10 billion. Again, according to Ryan Cragen, religion gets bailed out via tax exemptions to the tune of $71 billion per year on property taxes alone. So we, the people of America, bail out the religion industry to the tune of 7 times the U.S. government bailout of Morgan Stanley every year on property taxes alone. Yet nobody, except us, complains, and the politicians do nothing. The counterintuitive conservatives are only partially right. Taxing the churches fairly will result in the closure of some churches, but only the ones that refuse to actually perform nonprofit services will be affected. Any church, even the poorest of the poor churches, could perform a community service, declare its income, and stay open as a nonprofit if it wanted to. The only churches that would close as a result of fair taxation are the ones that refuse to provide real community service, Outreach, which many churches call community service, is not real community service, but rather marketing, and to disclose their funds like everyone else, yet cannot support itself with non-tax-deductible donations. I have no problem with that. We must admit that religion is a corrupt, or at least corruption-friendly industry that requires, at minimum, the same basic oversight as everyone else, and we must be willing to say it loudly. That religion is given such a widespread buy on laws, oversight, and accountability damages every citizen in tangible ways, and it's the biggest problem we face in our fight for equality, as well as the most cherished possession of the corrupt preacher. We, as taxpayers, have been making the choice to sit silent while our government and our wallets have been bled dry by religion, with some pastors flying in private jets and some priests living in stately tax-free mansions. According to Business Insider, the Vatican is the third largest landowner in the world, and all the Catholic churches, schools, and most of its other holdings pay no property taxes at all. Again, because God. And what does that even mean, really? Since all religion is individual, and the gods to which people pray are actually invented by the individual believers themselves, God wants actually just means I want, and God believes just means I believe. It's a great Nuremberg style of defense. I don't want to break the law, but my God wants me to. I'm not a bigot, my God is. That allows religious people to separate self-interest from their demands and opinions, riding religious privilege to benefit their personal goals. Remember, God wants this equals I want this. So when we are talking about religious exemptions, we are talking about exemptions from laws only because some people want to be exempted and are using their God to legitimize and elevate their wants and desires above civil law. This is why the RFRA and laws like it are so dangerous. They allow people to break laws if they say they think their God, which always agrees with them, wants them to. I say we've had enough. I say we need to make a change. There's no reason for religion to appear anywhere in the legal code except to protect free exercise, which does not mean freedom to break the law or gain special privileges from the government or to infringe on other people's free exercise. To include any exception or special right for religion elevates it without need or warrant. To say religion gets special treatment of any kind promotes religion, usually at the expense of other religions or the atheists, and that's not what government is all about. Indeed, it is the exact opposite of what our government is all about. Any place the law provides an exception for religion is illegal, prejudicial, and un-American, and it harms the population by creating huge opportunities for rampant corruption, and it must be recognized as such. While I'm talking about privilege, I need to mention the confidentiality of confessionals, aka priest-penitent privilege. An accessory to a crime is defined as, quote, one who, without being present at the commission of an offense, becomes guilty of such offense not as a chief actor but as a participant, as by command, advice, instigation, or concealment after the fact. If I know you committed a crime and I stay silent, I'm an accessory to that crime, which makes me guilty of a punishable offense, and the accessory is generally punished with the same severity as the person who committed the crime. This is a good law. After all, if I know you molested a child and I stay silent, I leave you on the street to molest more children. The bad part of this law is that, once again, the law is not handled evenly, as every priest in the country who hears a confession is protected from this crime. All across the country, crimes are being reported to priests who are bound by canon law not to reveal the secrets heard during confession. But Vatican canon law is not American civil law. You'd think the civil law would be paramount, but no. We in America have religious exemptions from our accessory law. According to Andrew Chow at findlaw.com, quote, statements made to a minister, priest, rabbi, or other religious leader are generally considered privileged or confidential communications. State laws generally exempt a pastor from having to testify in court or to law enforcement about what was discussed in a church confession, end quote. Priest-penitent privilege, as it is called even though it refers to any confessions made in confidence to any clergy, began in 1813 with a case called People v. Phillips. The court stated in its opinion, "It is essential to the free exercise of religion that its ordinance should be administered. The sinner will not confess, nor the priest receive his confession, if the veil of secrecy is removed." End quote. Essentially, the court found that free exercise of religion outweighed the secular need to require preachers to testify. We've been building on this flawed concept for over 200 years. Today, priest-penitent privilege is regulated on a state and federal level. While most states' laws have exceptions that mandate preachers report child abuse learned in confession, our legal research has not yielded a single case where any preacher has revealed the contents of a confession, even to save the life of a child. And we've found no exemptions in any state for murder, rape, or terrorism. In addition, the Federal Rule of Evidence 501 recognizes communications to a clergyman as a privilege in federal cases. There is no way to tell how many criminals are walking the streets today because priests stay silent, and there's no way for us to know how many more crimes have been committed because these known-to-priests repeat criminals are protected by exemptions that should not exist. There's no way to know how many of our nation's children have been hurt because of this truly asinine legal policy. The accessory law has some secular exemptions, the most obvious of which is for psychotherapists. In many cases, they are exempt from accessory laws for reasonable, secular reasons. But these exemptions end where someone else's life is in danger, as described by NOLO.com. Quote, "Most states have an exemption to the psychotherapist-patient privilege for dangerous patients, often referred to as the Tarasoff duty. Depending on the jurisdiction, the exemption either allows or requires therapists to report statements by patients that indicate dangerousness. In California, for example, therapists must disclose statements when the patient presents a risk of serious harm to others and disclosure is necessary to prevent that harm. The therapist's required course of action depends on the circumstances and can involve notifying the potential victim, the police, or both. For instance, if a patient tells her psychiatrist that she plans on shooting her ex-boyfriend, the psychiatrist may have to notify the police and warn the former beau." End quote. Psychotherapists are required by law to put their confidentiality with their patients aside in the case of imminent danger to someone else. That's good and reasonable because it places the needs of the many innocent people over the need of the one patient/criminal. Another well-known confidentiality privilege is that of attorneys and their clients. One might think that anything one says to a lawyer is confidential, but again, this is not true, according to NOLO.com. Quote, "The confidentiality of attorney-client communications usually does not extend to statements pertaining to future frauds or crimes. The government can compel a defense lawyer to testify to a client's statement about a future crime. In emergency or life-threatening situations, a lawyer might have to reveal such a statement to the police even before the crime is committed." End quote. So we have a law that protects confidentiality, with some reasonable exceptions to that law, so as not to place anyone in imminent danger. All exemptions from accessory laws end when a person seems about to commit a crime against someone, in which case people are expected to do the right thing and turn in the person, unless we're talking about religion. If the accessory is a priest, there are virtually no limits to the exemptions. Priests can choose not to turn in any criminal and get away with it, even when the criminal commits crime after heinous crime over and over. The reason? Canon law prohibits disclosure. That's all. Whatever you did, your secret is safe with the Catholic Church, and you are absolved of your sin. You're going to heaven. You're welcome. Here's the collection plate. Wait, did I just imply the Catholic Church is resisting turning in criminals because criminals have money and they make huge donations to the church in exchange for absolution? Yep, and we let it happen to our own detriment. Kathy Caridi, JCL, writes about this on Catholic Exchange and explains how a priest turning in even the worst of the criminals would be impossible. Quote, Canon 983.1 tells us right up front that the sacramental seal is inviolable, and thus it is absolutely wrong for a confessor in any way to betray the penitent, for any reason whatsoever, whether by word or in any other fashion. If, for example, a person confesses that he is a serial killer who is being sought by the authorities, and the priest recognizes his identity, he cannot contact the police and reveal it. This is true even if the person indicates that he intends to commit another crime. End quote. We're not talking about psychotherapists or lawyers, where confidentiality might have a secular purpose. We're talking about churches saying nothing about dangerous criminals as a matter of tradition, affecting the safety of every person in this country. That's U.S. law subverted by religious law to the direct and dangerous detriment of every citizen in this country. We, the citizens, put up with it because of tradition, and if we challenge it, we're being hostile to the Catholic Church. They do wrong, and if we complain, we're the bad guys. I hope you can see the parallel between this law and the IRS law I mentioned earlier. They both provide extra perks to religion and only religion. They both harm the citizens at large, either financially via higher taxes or by increasing the likelihood of violent crime. They both put religion on a pedestal over secular law. Most people think tax exemption laws are the same for secular and religious 501c3 organizations, but they are not the same, and religious organizations get substantial advantages over their secular counterparts to the financial detriment of the citizenry for no reason other than tradition. Similarly, most people think confidentiality laws are the same for secular and religious institutions, but they are not the same, and religion gets a substantial privilege, even to the detriment of the citizenry, for no reason other than tradition. Every priest who hears a confession is, by definition, an accessory to every crime he hears about and does not report to authorities. If canon law requires a priest to remain silent about what he hears in confession, canon law is immoral. My God wants me to break the law is not a legal defense, or at least it shouldn't be. Here's an example. A new case making major news is that of a priest in Baton Rouge who would rather go to jail than testify about child abuse, even though the penitent waives confidentiality. This case involves a girl who was 14 in 2008 who said she told her parish priest, Father Behe, pastor of St. John the Baptist Parish in Zachary, in confessional, that she was abused by a now dead lay member of the parish. But even though the penitent wants what she said to be revealed, the Catholic Church is calling it an attack on their freedom to have to obey the same laws as everyone else. This is an important example because the state Supreme Court has determined that the privilege of confidentiality can only be claimed on behalf of the person, the penitent. Since the female minor had waived her privilege, Father Behe could not claim confidentiality to protect himself from testifying. The court's statement, while heading in the right ethical direction, underscores that if the penitent does not waive confidentiality, the priest is within his rights to keep silent. The Baton Rouge Diocese complains in its response, quote, A foundational doctrine of the Roman Catholic Church for thousands of years mandates that the seal of confession is absolute and inviolable. Pursuant to his oath to the Church, a priest is compelled never to break that seal. If necessary, the priest would have to suffer a finding of contempt in civil court and suffer imprisonment rather than violate his sacred duty and violate the seal of confession and his duty to the penitent. End quote. The statement notes, quote, For a civil court to inquire as to whether or not a factual situation establishes the sacrament of confession is a clear and unfettered violation of the Establishment Clause of the Constitution of the United States, end quote. So their defense is, we've done it this way for a long time. followed by an obviously disingenuous, even inquiring about whether this is valid, is against the law. No, it does not break the law for us to consider legislation that usurps religious tradition in favor of the safety of our children, and of course, they know that. Unfortunately, even after all the pedophilia scandals in the church, they still have not learned to put people first. They still seek to hide criminals. If a civil law has a purpose, that purpose is not negated because of Vatican tradition and thousand-year-old oaths. Caridi opines, quote, "If, however, our laws were to change dramatically and our priests were legally obliged to report the confessions of penitents who had admitted committing certain crimes, it is impossible to imagine that the Vatican would permit them to do this. The principle of the sacramental seal is so strong and so absolute that it is, unfortunately, easy to imagine a priest being obliged to violate the laws of his local jurisdiction rather than betray the trust of someone who has confessed his sins to him." End quote. How this change would affect the Vatican should not be anyone's concern, especially when the safety of our citizenry is involved, but I speculate that the Vatican would respond the same way it has always responded when justice is forced on it. It would evolve to meet the situation. The Vatican would find a way to justify a change, either by revelation or reinterpretation, and poof, they can change their practices and stop helping criminals. The church becomes more moral and helps put bad people in jail instead of telling them God forgives them and setting them free on the population to do it again. Of course, we can't look at the Vatican's past performance with regard to the safety of the population and expect them to just do the right thing. Saying that gave me a bit of a chuckle. So we need to change the laws to make it happen. Current federal law, the previously mentioned RFRA, requires the government to show compelling interest before restricting free exercise of religion. People v. Phillips asserted that the free exercise of religion outweighed America's need for preachers to divulge what they hear in the confessional. But, especially when we are talking about penitents who repeatedly engage in murder, rape, terrorism, pedophilia, and other heinous crimes, I assert that we, as American citizens, have a compelling interest in mandating reporting with actual penalties for noncompliance for these crimes that supersedes preachers' freedom to exercise confidentiality. Indeed, if the immediate safety of others, including children, doesn't constitute a compelling interest on behalf of the state, it's hard to imagine what would. Removing religious exemptions to accessory laws, at least to the same degree as lawyers and psychotherapists, is good for everyone except the criminals, and that it is against religious tradition or canon law does not negate this truth or this need. The safety of the many, the few, or the one outweighs all the combined ego and tradition of the Vatican. While American Atheists works this issue, we as a movement need to let our politicians know that this is a real problem that affects all of us and benefits the very, very few. We need to make this an issue for our own sake. In summary, it's time to treat religions fairly. It's time we tax them fairly, treat their employees fairly, and hold them fairly accountable for all of their actions. It's time we hold politicians responsible for defending religious discrimination in our nation's laws. It's time we demand extreme religious equality. Obey the law, even if you think your God says you don't have to. Simple stuff. The 9/11 Miracle Cross Case. On September 11, 2001, religious terrorists murdered almost 3,000 Americans in the name of their God. They were not selective in their murders. They killed everyone equally, regardless of religion or lack thereof. The Twin Towers were made of crossbeams, and thousands of those crossbeams survived the carnage. One Christian worker selected one of these crossbeams and attached a religious symbolism to it, imbuing holiness onto the wreckage. He supposed this specific crossbeam was not scrap metal like all the others, but rather was a sign from heaven that, quote, God had not abandoned us. My original thoughts on this still stand. The World Trade Center cross has become a Christian icon. It has been blessed by so-called holy men and presented as a reminder that God, who couldn't be bothered to stop the terrorists or prevent the 3,000 people from being killed in his name, cared only enough to bestow upon us some rubble that resembles a cross. My quote for our press release angered Sarah Palin, who quoted me in her vacuous book, Good Tidings and Great Joy, and responded with a stereotypical deflecting comment, quote, so much for not wanting anyone to be offended, end quote, before she tried to make it about atheists persecuting Christians by demanding equality. Yes, that was her response to my assertion that God, who knew 9/11 was going to happen and did nothing to stop it, told us he hadn't abandoned us after he'd abandoned us by giving us a piece of metal that looks like a cross. The statement is true if God is real, but her only response was to say it was offensive and evade my point. This evasiveness only hints at how far the religious will go to defend their God's uselessness. Anyway, New York City priest Father Brian Jordan seized on the opportunity and a holy relic was invented. According to reporter Becky Garrison, hardly any first responders and a few other volunteers and workers began holding weekly services with Father Jordan at the cross, but the money and the publicity machine around the cross had begun. The cross was moved, repaired, mounted, and exploited. Lies about the miracle cross began to surface. Suddenly, the services at the cross supposedly drew hundreds of people, not just a few. Suddenly, the cross was unique, not one of thousands. Suddenly, the cross was formed miraculously by God, not a human in the tower's construction crew. And suddenly, the miracle cross was for sale, in the form of trinkets purchasable through the church gift shops and websites. Hallelujah. For years, the cross sat in front of St. Peter's Church, earning money through both purchases and donations. There, the worshipers further modified it, carving Jesus on the top, etching prayers on the side, and removing, adapting, and replacing the shroud, the metal that covers one piece of the cross, to make it look even more overtly Christian. Then, with little notice, the cross was installed in the World Trade Center Museum in a religious ceremony led by, who else, Father Jordan, who pronounced the cross representative of all people of faith. He then consecrated the public land on which the museum is built, and the cross was lowered in. Then, to justify the inclusion, the World Trade Center Memorial Foundation Board declared the cross secular. The museum holds artifacts and photos from before, during, and after 9/11, including a fire truck that was damaged in the rescue effort. Was the fire truck installed by a priest in a religious ceremony on consecrated land? No. Why? Because this is a secular item. Only religious items would be installed in religious ceremonies. The miracle cross is Christian, and Christian only. It does not represent all faiths, but rather one specific faith, and we all know it. Subtract the Christianity from the cross, and you've got scrap metal, like all the other crossbeams that survived the event. Furthermore, it must be made clear that the cross is not neutral to non-Christians. It's a symbol of oppression and intolerance to adherents of many other religions and atheists, and this is a good example of why. To place the 17-foot-tall cross in the World Trade Center Museum is simply using the fact that the towers were made out of crossbeams to justify installing a huge and unambiguously Christian salute to greet all visitors. The cross's inclusion is an attempt to Christianize 9/11, implying Christians were the main victims and pushing the rest of us off to the side. The World Trade Center Board contends this cross is a secular artifact, but its actions concede the point that it is not. In July of 2011, the 9/11 Memorial Foundation confirmed that a small Star of David and a Jewish prayer shawl had also been included. These are not artifacts by any definition, but were added for inclusiveness. Jews apparently didn't like being represented by a Christian symbol. Hindu holy water was also included, a comparatively tiny religious icon to represent the Hindu people who were also apparently not happy being represented by the miracle cross. Even when combined, these religious symbols are dwarfed by the 17-foot-tall cross. If the World Trade Center board is going to install a Christian memorial, they should not lie and say it's not Christian. Rather, they should admit it is religious, just as the Star of David and the Hindu holy water are, and in compliance with federal law, they should include equal representation for the estimated 500 atheists, far more than the number of Jews and Hindus lost, who died in these religiously motivated attacks. We demanded from the board what we could legally demand: equality. The way it was accomplished, by removing the cross or by acknowledging the atheists, would be up to them. American Atheists even offered to pay for an atheist memorial at the site and to allow the World Trade Center board to approve the design or even to dedicate an existing exhibit to the non-religious victims. This would have meant nothing more than putting a sign next to an existing exhibit, an easy enough solution. But they turned us down, and we were called un-American, unpatriotic, and insensitive for making the request. They were not serious about seeking inclusion and diversity. Once again, we were bad for demanding equal treatment. Why won't they honor our just and legal request? Because it would further dilute the Christian monopoly to have other religious demographics represented. Fairness would equalize what they most obviously want to be: unequal. Equality is an all-or-nothing concept. Public officials, or those who manage public property or use public funds, do not get to say some religious positions are okay and others are not. We all have equal rights, and America's atheists are not being treated equally at the World Trade Center. If the World Trade Center board insists on bringing in religious symbols, it needs to include everyone who wishes to be included. It can keep the miracle cross, the Star of David, and the Hindu holy water. But then we must all be represented. Equality from the government is fair, legal, and the American way. It is not important that people on the World Trade Center board don't like atheists. We are equal anyway. It doesn't matter that the cross is one of thousands of wrecked crossbeams. It's still unmistakably Christian. It doesn't matter if it's inconvenient for the World Trade Center board to include multiple religious icons. If they include one, they have to include everyone. That's the law they've broken in an attempt to Christianize the events of September 11th, and that's why American Atheists filed this case. An unfortunate addendum. The Second Circuit Court upheld the dismissal of our case by the lower court, and this, unfortunately, is going to kill our case for now. In effect, the higher court, while affirming our standing, stated this is not a First Amendment issue because museums can have religious art, so this museum can have the cross. It doesn't matter that this is not art. It's rubbish that looks like a cross because it was built that way. But the court seems to think that it's better for the World Trade Center to include a religious icon by pretending it's art rather than account for everyone equally in a place that only exists because of religious intolerance. It also came out in statements before the court that the other religious icons had not been installed after all, at least not yet. In accordance with our legal philosophy, I've observed that the current makeup of the Supreme Court is simply not conducive to reversing cases like ours, and I do not want secular art crosses to be the law of the land, so this case will die here unless something happens to improve our chances of winning. Of course, the issue is not dead. We will see this issue again. I predict the next step will be replicas of the 9/11 cross, or paintings of it, or carvings on public land and other future memorials. These, in turn, will be used as a justification for more secular crosses, including inside courtrooms. Baby steps. And we will be there. Benches and other atheist monuments. Another place we see this intrusion of religion into the public sphere is the blatantly unconstitutional act of placing the Decalogue, aka the Ten Commandments, on public land alone, regardless that most of these commandments are contradictory to American civil law. Indeed, seven of the Ten Commandments, 8 if you're Catholic, are not laws, and some directly contradict the American way. Consider them for yourself. Commandment 1, Thou shalt have no other gods before me, the exact opposite of freedom of religion. Commandment 2, No graven images, unless you're Catholic, and also the exact opposite of freedom of religion. Commandment 3, Remember the Sabbath and keep it holy, the exact opposite of freedom of religion. Commandment 4, Don't take God's name in vain, the exact opposite of freedom of religion and speech. Commandment 6, Don't kill. Hey, this one doesn't contradict American law. It's a shame that it predates the Old Testament by hundreds of years. Commandment 7, Don't steal. That's 2, but also not original to the Old Testament. Commandment 8, Don't lie. Not a law. Commandment 9, Don't covet thy neighbor's stuff. Coveting is the fuel of capitalism. Of course you covet your neighbor's Mercedes. Otherwise, there's no incentive to work hard and buy your own. Commandment 10, Don't covet thy neighbor's wife. Not law. My point is to show you how far apart biblical laws are from American law and how we must all be cognizant of the implications of religious declarations of a stronger linkage. In 2013, American atheists negotiated with Stark, Florida, to allow us to achieve yet another first for atheists, a permanent monument representing the atheist perspective on public land. Once again, this was a defensive move, as a huge Ten Commandments display had been placed on public land in the center quad of the town's municipal building. This was clearly illegal, despite what certain Christian apologists would have you believe, and the city had no choice but to allow us equal time and equal prominence if it wanted to keep the Decalogue. To be clear, this is not what we wanted. We wanted the Ten Commandments removed and the town square clean and green, but we don't get to make that decision. As in the World Trade Center Memorial case, we have the right to demand equality, not the right to choose the method by which that equality is granted. There was inequality in that one monument clearly endorsed one religion, and the city had to fix it. However, the option of giving us the monument versus taking down the Ten Commandments was up to them. The city chose the former, and had we decided not to take them up on the offer, the Ten Commandments would have stayed there permanently and without opposition. We designed the bench as a team, led mainly by Ken Lukinen, American Atheist Director of Regional Operations. It includes quotes from America's founding fathers, Madeline Murray O'Hare, and the Treaty of Tripoli. We further included the punishments in the Bible for breaking the Ten Commandments, most of which are death. We included the punishments to drive home an important point. The Ten Commandments are not some benign laws on which all good people can agree. It's not enough to combat the lie, previously addressed, that they are the basis of law in this country. We must take the next step, read the commandments in context, and see them for what they are, hate speech. And no, I'm not being hyperbolic. According to USLegal.com, hate speech is, quote, the expression of hatred for some group, especially in circumstances in which the communication is likely to provoke violence. It is an incitement to hatred primarily against a group of persons defined in terms of race, ethnicity, national origin, gender, religion, sexual orientation, and the like, end quote. The first commandment reads, I am the Lord thy God, thou shalt have no other gods before me. Which, according to TheologyNetwork.org, Martin Luther interpreted as, quote, thou shalt have and worship me alone as thy God, end quote. Luther went on to say, quote, therefore it is the intent of this commandment to require true faith and trust of the heart, which settles upon the only true God and clings to him alone, end quote. The parody but delightfully accurate site LandoverBaptist.org describes the penalties for breaking this commandment. Quote, genocide. Entire cities with men, women, children, and animals must be killed. Deuteronomy chapter 2, verses 33-34. Numbers chapter 21, verses 34-35. 1 Samuel chapter 15, verses 2-3. Joshua chapter 6, verse 21. Joshua chapter 10, verse 40. In some cases, you can keep the girls alive for raping. Numbers 31, verses 15 to 18, end quote. This surely qualifies as inciting violence, yet it sits on our government property. So what is placed on the public lawn is a statement that, read in context, requires atheists, polytheists, and believers in gods other than the ones cited in the Ten Commandments to be killed by order of God solely for their religious beliefs or absence thereof. Yes, the other commandments have different punishments, including the one the Catholics decided to omit. Catholics skip over the no graven images of anything that is in heaven commandment because it was apparently inconvenient to obey it. But my point here is that the posting of the Ten Commandments on public property is not something atheists should ignore. It's hateful, it has inspired and still recommends murder of us and a whole lot of other people, and it should not be tolerated as something that should ever be promoted by the government. We place those punishments on the monument to highlight the barbarism of the Old Testament and the rules contained therein. I've said it before and will continue to repeat. In America, atheism's greatest problem is that Christians don't read their Bibles. We hope that by placing the punishments on the monument, people will see just a small piece of the Bible for the horrid immorality it represents and will be motivated to read the rest. This is not new information. The Christians who run organizations trying to place the Decalogue on public land know it's horrible in statement and implication and defend it with statements like, well, in the New Testament, Jesus changes things. Why then are they not placing the words of Jesus on public grounds? Why are we talking about commandments that promote intolerance and not a plaque of the Sermon on the Mount, for instance, which is much nicer and more representative of what many of today's Christians represent? Why aren't Christian organizations championing the placement of the Golden Rule? Simple. The Christian organizations want and need to include the Jews. They don't want to fight the Jewish organizations who would probably, selfishly, want to put up their own monument if the Christian monument didn't include them, like when they demand a menorah be placed next to a manger scene. They want the Jewish people on their side, not ours, so they place something that, at least on the surface, includes them, even if the message is antiquated by even modern Christian standards, because they know that when most people see the Ten Commandments, they think about Christianity, not Judaism. This issue is about perceived endorsement. Once again, religion is weak and cannot thrive without the government pushing it. Christian organizations place these monuments not so anyone will read or think about them. Indeed, they are counting on the opposite. They want people to walk by, see the Ten Commandments, associate that with Christianity, sorry Jews, but this isn't about you after all, and walk away with a clear perception that the government is endorsing the Christian religion. Once again, this is all about Christian privilege. Before the atheist monument went up in Stark, the Men's Christian Fellowship, the group that originally sponsored the Ten Commandments monument, had exactly what it wanted. In no way could someone walk into the main courtyard, see the huge Decalogue, and not perceive it as an endorsement of Christianity. Then, with one monument, we changed that around completely. Now, with both monuments in view, the unmistakable perception is that the city of Stark does not endorse any one religion. With the bench, the statement went from definitely endorses Christianity only to definitely does not endorse Christianity only, and by the way, atheists are equal, thereby completely negating the unstated intent of the Decalogue sponsors while normalizing atheism. The good news is that the law is on our side. McCreary County versus ACLU, Van Orden versus Perry, and the Supreme Court made clear distinctions as to when religious displays are allowed on public land. Simply put, if they are a part of a larger display, it's okay to include a Decalogue as part of a free speech zone. If, however, a Decalogue sits alone, it's illegal. These cases gave us clear guidance on where we, as atheists, are entitled to equal representation in the public square. This is why there will be more monuments, because to the Christians pushing these monuments, it's not about speech or expression, but rather favoritism and legitimization. We can and will use the same strategy, using free speech zones, according to McCreary, to promote an atheistic perspective wherever Christians try to use them to gain preferential treatment. In doing so, we will use the law to negate and indeed deter further placements. When a Christian group wants to stick a monument on public land, they need to know we are waiting to do the same. When a municipality considers free speech zones, they will remember that we have free speech too, and placing a Christian monument means they'll soon be placing an atheist monument. We hope they will choose to keep their quads green instead. One final note. When I say I want a green quad, I mean it. We don't want any monuments up at all, including ours. We only put up ours as a defensive move when a religious display is already installed or planned. Therefore, when the city of Stark, or any future municipality, decides that it wants all monuments removed, American atheists will gladly pick up the tab to remove our monument after the Ten Commandments are removed. Stark's quad can be monument-free again anytime the city wishes. In the meantime, please visit Stark, Florida, where RoadsideAmerica.com now lists our monument as a tourist attraction. The Utah Highway Patrol Association cross case. I often say we are the good guys who get treated like we are the bad guys. Nowhere is this better illustrated than in Utah, where American atheists, before the World Trade Center Memorial case, fought successfully to have roadside crosses removed. Utah had a law that disallowed roadside memorials, which was later modified to allow memorials for fallen state troopers. However, the only monument design allowed for a trooper was a 12-foot-tall cross. The Utah Highway Patrol Association would not allow a deviation from that design, even if the dead trooper had not been Christian. But that's not what they said, and that's not how they argued. In an August 19, 2010 debate against me on Fox News Live, the Utah Attorney General, Mark Shurtleff, asserted, quote, "We've offered. If a Jew dies and they want to put up a Star of David, that's fine," end quote. However, in the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals decision of December 20th of that year, the judges noted, quote, "Notwithstanding the Utah Highway Patrolmen's Association's position, the state defendants, in oral arguments before the district court and in their briefs and argument before us, asserted they would not allow any change in the memorial, whether to accommodate other faiths or otherwise." Did the Attorney General go on TV and get the main point of our contention wrong, or did he attempt to cover up the truth? If he got it wrong, he was incompetent, which is difficult to accept from a person in that position. If he was covering, why? Perhaps he was hiding the true intent of the monuments in the first place. They could have memorialized the troopers with obelisks like the Washington Monument. Shurtleff asserted nobody would know what that means. Flags or statues. Instead, they chose a cross and disallowed other monuments. Had they chosen the cross and allowed other monuments, there would have been much less room for a legal challenge. But that would be an admission that the cross is Christian. If they had used a non-religious symbol, there would have been no challenge at all. If the crosses were on private land, there would have been no challenge at all. Why, then, would they choose to place religious symbols on public land to memorialize the troopers and not allow for deviation in the case of religious difference and claim on TV that they would allow for such deviation, which stifled opposing arguments? All questions lead to one answer. They wanted to set a precedent that the crosses are secular. The Utah Highway Patrol Association asserted that the cross is a secular representation and not religious, and therefore mounting giant crosses up and down the highways of Utah was not a violation of the separation of religion and government. Much like the argument in the World Trade Center cross case, Christians used dead people to shield their attempt to cloak the cross in false secularism. If the cross is declared a secular object, then anyone can place secular crosses in any public school, courtroom, or anywhere without worrying about equal representation. You can imagine a school shooting followed by grieving parents being manipulated by the local church to place a secular cross on school property using the Utah Highway Patrolmen's Association crosses as a valid precedent. Remember, baby steps. Besides, who would fight against bereaved parents of a dead child who want to put up a cross on public grounds? We would. When we fought against the lie in Utah that the cross is not Christian, we were accused of, quote, fighting against the grieving families of dead troopers, end quote. How horrible we atheists must be. In reality, we were fighting against people apparently using dead troopers to push a dishonest agenda of creating a precedent for the secularizing of the cross for the sole purpose of getting it on public land once again for the actual purpose of securing Christian privilege. Now, that's a horrible thought. But if you were really trying to memorialize the troopers, and all you had to do was have a secular symbol, or allow multiple religious symbols, or place them on private land, why would you choose to break the law and incite a lawsuit instead? Why would you fight it all the way to the Supreme Court? Why would you apparently misrepresent this policy on television? Remember, what is being represented on TV may sway public opinion, but it is not legally binding. The troopers died in service to a constitution that Shurtleff and the UHPA were apparently trying to circumvent using the troopers as a shield. Yet American Atheists and I were accused of being bad guys for trying to stop people from using dead heroes to break the law. This is what we do, and this is why we do it. Popular opinion be damned. In a Rasmussen Reports poll, 72% of Americans disagreed with our case. But they were wrong, so we swam upstream and we won. Meanwhile, this case cost Utah residents nearly $400,000 in legal bills. We are going to see this kind of encroachment again, and we will fight it again. The nationwide attempt to create legal precedent for a secular cross is pervasive and wholly dishonest. Secular crosses are impossible in today's society. It doesn't matter that the symbol itself predates Christianity any more than the swastika used to be a sign of peace and predates Hitler. Today, the cross is Christian, undeniably so, just as the swastika is unavoidably a Nazi symbol. To say otherwise is pure sophistry. The argument for secular religious symbols is certainly one we expect to see more of, and it isn't unique to the cross. In July of 2013, headlines were made over objections by the Freedom From Religion Foundation to a proposed Holocaust memorial for the Ohio Statehouse lawn funded with public money. The problem? It was adorned with a Jewish star, and only a Jewish star, ignoring the 40% of the victims of the Nazi atrocities who were not Jewish. I opposed this structure because it followed the same logic as the Utah and the World Trade Center crosses. Yet again, proponents said that the religious symbol, the star, was secular, and that it represented the Jewish people, or Israel, or wasn't solely Jewish. That's all crap. Just as anyone who drove by a huge steel cross would clearly think Christian, or drove by a swastika and think Nazi, so too would any reasonable person who drove by a Jewish star think Judaism, and only Judaism. Predictably, I was called a dick, and worse, by religionists and the tabloid atheists as well, but I remain unapologetic. If the star is ultimately allowed to stand, it will surely be used as a precedent for crosses in the near future, with Christian cries of, "You let the Jews do it, so if you don't let us do it, you're discriminating." Wait and see. Assaults on the separation of religion and government will remain a fixture of the American political and cultural landscape for the foreseeable future. American atheists will continue to follow its legal philosophy in picking its battles. Just as Bill O'Reilly attempted to reclassify Christianity as a philosophy in order to justify government endorsement of his religion, so too are other religionists willing to lie about the religious nature of their symbols to get them on public land and preserve the legitimacy and privilege religion desires so badly. It's understandable given the nearly inevitable demise of religious power in America, but it's also dishonest and illegal. And American atheists will continue to call it out and fight it because in the service of good, we're not afraid to risk being called bad guys.